Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're ready to start this hearing of the Minnesota Health and Human Services Reform Committee. Just by way of starting things off here, as our members arrive, I want to thank the testifiers for being here today. This is a very important and sensitive issue for the public safety of Minnesota, and we are here to find out more about the process. We are not here to make personal attacks or castigate particular people, but this is a fact-finding hearing on behalf of the Reform Committee with the intent of understanding this more. To my knowledge, this is the first time we are doing this, and so it is vitally important that we as policymakers and Minnesotans in general understand what we're doing and why we're doing it. And so that is the purpose of this hearing. With that, I will I'll welcome our testifiers for their presentation. Commissioner Jessen, you're earning frequent flyer miles this week in our committees, and I thank you for being here. And Mr. Benson, thank you for being here as well. I'll ask our testifiers to simply introduce themselves, who they represent, and then begin their testimony. We will take member questions, by the way, after the presentation, so if we can hold questions until after the presentation. Given our current attendance, I'll probably have to repeat that later, but please proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm Lucinda Jessen. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Human Services.
Good afternoon. My name is George Widseth. I'm an attorney in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office.
And Mr. Chair and members, I'm Dennis Benson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program.
Very good. Welcome to the committee. Who wants to start us off? Commissioner Jessen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I want to first thank you for this opportunity to provide you and really the public with more information about the processes that are required under Minnesota law around the provisional discharge of our civilly committed sex offenders. You know, now I want to start off by acknowledging that this is a hard subject. It is hard because public safety is involved, and public safety is at the heart of our core services in government. It's hard because it's a complex process. Often we're looking both first at the correctional system and what happened there, and then at a complex civil commitment process. And it's hard because people who are civilly committed almost always have committed vicious crimes, and they've hurt or killed many innocent people. So I just, you know, want to acknowledge that and thank you for your attention to this subject as we go into this today. Before I jump into the substance of my testimony, I want to just make it clear what I'm planning on addressing, what our Minnesota Sex Offender Treatment Program, I'll say MSOP if that's okay from now on, Executive Director Dennis Benson will address, and what Assistant Hennepin County Attorney George Witseth will be addressing. And hopefully between the three of us, we can answer all of your questions. So we're going to start with Dennis Benson, who's going to address the overall landscape of civil commitment of sexually dangerous persons under Minnesota law. And just very briefly go through kind of the treatment process at MSOP. Assistant County Attorney Widseth is going to address really the very detailed legal and judicial processes required to be followed on any petition for what we call a reduction in custody, which includes provisional discharge, but as George will explain, also includes some other things as well. So he'll go through that process. And I think, as many of you all know, under state law, as commissioner, I have certain responsibilities. And in my testimony after them, I'm going to address how I approach these petitions. And as part of this, both Mr. Widseth and I will not only talk about the process, but we will discuss our decision-making on the most recent case, the Opine case, where the court approved a provisional discharge petition. But I just want to make it clear there's some things we can't talk about. You know, so our testimony can't include a lot of particular details about any MSOP client, unless it's what's in kind of a limited part of public court records, because the Government Data Practices Act prohibits disclosure of a lot of that information, and the federal HIPAA law, privacy law, also covers our clients and similarly prohibits disclosure of a lot of individualized information. But, you know, before I hand this off to Dennis Benson, I just want to say how fortunate we are, really, to have Dennis head up our sex offender treatment program. You know, Dennis has done this, I think, since 2008. He's a longtime public servant in the Corrections Department. And I must say, as Commissioner, I was just delighted when he agreed to stay on and remain in this role and be part of the Dayton administration. So, Dennis, with that, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Benson, welcome to the committee.
And members, again, I am Dennis Benson, and I have been with this program now since 2008, as the Commissioner mentioned. Prior to that, I served about 34 years in the Department of Corrections. My most recent position was 12 years as a Deputy Commissioner. So I followed this process both during my time in corrections and obviously very closely since I came over here. I think it's important to understand, because there is oftentimes confusion about the roles of the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services.
Mr. Benson, I'm going to stop you just for a moment because we now have a quorum members, so I will officially call the meeting to order. And I will ask for a motion to approve our minutes from January 8th and January 14th. February. It's not correct on our agenda. It's February 8th, February 14th. And we have a motion from Representative Mack. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion is approved and our minutes are approved. So, all right. Mr. Benson, back to your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Just to clarify, most people understand that in corrections, individuals are sentenced to a specific period of time and in prison and in what we call supervised release in the community. A different process, we call that a criminal case. It's not a civilly committed case. In cases of individuals convicted of sex offenses, some of them participate in treatment, some don't. Corrections treat somewhere between 18% and 20% of the sex offenders that come into the correctional system. MSOP is required to provide treatment or be prepared to provide treatment to 100% of our individuals that come into our program if they so desire. They do have that choice as to whether or not they want to participate in treatment. Currently, we have a participation rate of about 85 to 87% on any given day, which is up from about 50% 5 or 6 years ago. So there's more and more interest in engaging in meaningful treatment in our program. Currently, there are 20 states and the federal government use civil commitment for sex offenders. Civil commitment generally occurs after individuals complete that prison sentence. They may or may not be referred to the county. The county then may or may not choose to file a petition, and Mr. Woodseth will go into more detail regarding that process as we move forward. But we've talked a lot about the referral process. So most of the people that end up in our program, civil commitment program, start in our prison system. All civil commitment programs must provide meaningful and individualized treatment and a meaningful pathway for safe reintegration into the community. As the Commissioner mentioned, the fundamental perfunctory responsibility is public safety, and we embrace that throughout our program and throughout this process. Minnesota MSOP provides a secure and intense treatment program and is reserved for individuals with very complex patterns of sexual perpetration. We also say frequently, courts in, courts out. This is a court-driven process. We don't decide who comes in, and we don't decide when they are ready for that next step into the community, in other words, provisional discharge. We weigh in certain areas, but it ultimately rests with the court, and it's in the hands of the court in terms of that provisional discharge. So usually we have been, in the last 3 years, we've talked a lot about the growth of this program and the fact that no one has been successfully provisionally discharged from the program. But today the focus is on the back end of the treatment program. And I'll provide some quick context about the program here. We currently have roughly 635 clients in the program across two sites. We have beginning stages of treatment occur up at Moose Lake, and the end stage of treatment, what we call phase three, occurs down at the St. Peter facility. So somebody coming in would start at Moose Lake, go through phase one and two, and then when they reach maximum treatment completion up there, they would then be transferred to St. Peter, where we refer to it as the end stage of treatment. I won't be speaking directly to the clinical model today because, to be frank, I'm not a clinician. I'm familiar with the treatment protocol. I've learned a lot in the last 38 years about treatment, both prison initiated sex offender treatment and our program, but I'll leave that to the professionals. But I can give you some just a snapshot of what that treatment looks like. Treatment delivered in our program is consistent with best practices and principles of risk, needs, and responsivity. Treatment is individualized to address each client's risk factors, and they're all very different, believe me. We have very high psychopathy individuals. We have low-functioning individuals. We have individuals that are in their 80s, and we have others that are in their 20s. We have individuals that have mental health challenges and issues, so it's critically important that for this population that the treatment is individualized. Clients acquire skills in group therapy and are provided opportunities to demonstrate meaningful change through participation in rehabilitative services. It's a 24/7 program. In the Office of Legislative Auditors report that we all got a look at a year ago, they talked about our treatment program and the fact that we needed to beef up treatment hours a little bit. And we have worked very hard at that in the last year. We've increased our treatment, and I believe that our program is very stable and consistent with best practices and is grounded in current research. We have hired a lot of new staff, but we have invested a lot of good training in those new or those young staff, and we believe that, again, we are on the cutting edge of what works in some cases with this population. According to other civil commitment programs, it takes 8 to 9 years of continuous participation to complete treatment, and that's been pretty consistent with our experience here in Minnesota. Less than 12% or 10% of civilly committed sex offenders have been provisionally discharged or released throughout the country in the 20 state programs and one federal program. There are three phases to treatment. Phase three, as I mentioned, phase three is a reintegration programming and is centered on very gradual and supported deinstitutionalization and reintegration back into the community. And we develop a unit that we call Community Preparation Service down at the St. Peter facility in 2008. We had our first client actually live there for a while in 2008, but it really opened in 2009. Today we have 10 individuals in Community Preparation Service. We have 11th on the way. We'll be with us shortly. So there's more and more movement through the treatment steps, step one, two, and this, of course, is step three, which follows them into the community. So step three doesn't stop when they leave Community Preparation Service. Now, just to explain what community prep is, it is a building outside of the secure perimeter. So these individuals live in we have both a house and a dormitory-like setting where individuals live outside of the razor ribbon. The individual that we're discussing today has been there for a couple of years very successfully. They go into the community escorted, and they have, when they initially come out there, they have both escorted and unescorted campus privileges. But that is part of that very slow reintegration process. The development of CPS was a major step for the program, and again, it's research-based, and it's one of a kind. There aren't a lot of programs that have something similar to this. And this is because in other states, clients may be in the program one day and out the next because their statute is written a little bit differently. We generally speaking see that coming, so we're able to move them through all steps of the program, which again I think is consistent with sound public safety practice. In Minnesota, civil commitment statutes provide for provisional discharge, full discharges. In provisional discharges, there are conditions of supervision and treatment that our clients have to follow. And that is a matter of public record, again, in the case that we're speaking about. So it's no secret what that provisional discharge plan looks like. Clients can petition for provisional discharge at any time, but are not supported by MSOP clinical staff until they've completed all steps of the program. Treatment progression decisions are never made in a vacuum. Primary therapists, treatment team, and clinical supervisors are very much involved in those recommendations. Mr. Woodseth will be providing an overview of the judicial process around petition for provisional discharge, but I'd like to provide details about what provisional discharge looks like. Although MSOP has not had a provisional discharge for many years, this court decision really was not a big surprise to us. We believed that we were going to have a provisional discharge in the next couple of years when I came in 2008. And now we have one before us. So we have been planning diligently about what makes sense, what's consistent with best practice to safely integrate this person back into the community. And we don't take this responsibility lightly. We have our own concerns. We all have families and nieces and nephews and kids, and we treat this with the greatest degree of caution that's possible, consistent with the constitutional issues that are also pressing, and the fact that we have a statute that really guides our thinking with respect to this process. We've obtained contracts with halfway houses and providers that specialize in the management of people that are being reintegrated into the community. We've developed a treatment model that will provide for continuity of care when the individual does go to the community, both the halfway house and then the next step after that. We've established protocol for active GPS monitoring, covert surveillance by our Office of Special Investigations if we believe that it's warranted. We will have daily contact with this individual initially upon placement in the halfway house and as he moves into a different community setting at one point. We'll be building wraparound support network services before the we've done that before he actually does go to the halfway house, but that will continue as he spends time there. We'll require sex offender registration and as established in statute, collaborating with local law enforcement to make sure that we touch all those bases. An order for provisional discharge was issued on February 10th, 2012. MSOP has a contract with Community Reentry Services, and the client will reside at one of their halfway houses. So again, just the bottom line here is we have a statute, we have a law, we have to follow the court's order. Again, while we may have an opinion on whether or not this individual is ready for provisional discharge, it is a court-ordered decision, and we're going to do everything we can to ensure public safety and do this right. And again, this is the first one. The first one is always more challenging than the second one or the third one. We appreciate your concerns, and we want to provide you with all of the information that we can about what will be occurring as we move through this process. There are no secrets here. We've made this program as transparent as HIPAA and other data privacy and practice provisions allow us to, but we must reconcile our first and highest priority of public safety with the intent of the statute and the constitutional concerns. And again, I believe that our program is sound. I believe that we have a very good clinical component in the state of Minnesota. I believe that the civil commitment process needs some tweaking. That's another issue for another day, but we all have had previous discussions around that, and hopefully we can continue that dialogue as well, because I think it's important, again, for constitutional reasons, cost issues, and because it is a concern of the policymakers. So thank you for the opportunity. I'm now going to turn it over to George and let him talk a little bit about the judicial procedures.
Thank you, Mr. Benson. Before we proceed, I just want to remind members, some who may not have been here when we started the committee meeting, we're here trying to understand this process. It's a fact-finding mission on behalf of our policy role as the Reform Committee in Health and Human Services. I again thank the testifiers for being here to help inform us about this. We are going to listen to the testifiers give their presentations and then take questions. So if you want to line up for questions, that's fine. We'll be taking those names down. And so much like we did yesterday, we'll listen to what's being presented and then ask our questions. And with that, we'll go to our next testifier. Mr. Whitseth, if you could identify yourself and who you represent and then proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am an assistant Hennepin County attorney, have been so since 1985. And I want to tell you, first of all, you folks look like my kind of jury. So I'd like to keep you along with me. I think it's important since...
You may want to wait until the end of the afternoon, Mr. Whitseth.
That's a typical problem for me. Thank you. I think it's important for you to get an idea of who I am before you listen to my words. I want you to know that since 1984, I've been a prosecutor. I've prosecuted high-profile homicides. I prosecuted homicides in Ramsey County and in Hennepin County. When I started Hennepin County, I was on the child sexual abuse team. So between those cases and homicides, that's what I did. I moved over to mental health court after doing a string of homicide cases involving the death of Jerry Hoff, who was a Minneapolis police officer. Now I deal with mental health court, although I coordinate with criminal court with when there are mental illness issues. Right now I'm involved in a case where a man killed his own baby. Part of my main work, though, is dealing with sex offenders. And we have a small unit of people in my office that typically get records from Department of Corrections. We find out about people who have a history of sex offenses. We get records. We meet as a team. We go over those records. And we decide whether or not to petition that person as a sexual psychopathic personality or sexually dangerous person, to shorten it SPP or SDP. once we made a decision as a team, we file the petition and the ball starts rolling. We gather as many records as we can. Psychologists are appointed and they interview the person that we're trying to commit. One of the nice things about this process for me is I get to sit in on interviews of the person we're trying to commit. I never got to do that as a prosecutor. So for 16 years now, I've been one of the four or five people in my office who have filed petitions for commitment of sexual predators. And for those same 16 years, I followed PP and SDP cases through the system, and when they try to petition to the Special Review Board or the Supreme Court Appeal Panel, typically that's me that's there. my office, I looked this up, I had no idea, but over the past 5 years, and as far as Special Review Boards and the Supreme Court Appeal Panel cases involving the PPs and SDPs, we've handled over 200. Of those cases, I have always, up until this current case, I have always objected to the proposed provisional discharge plan. This is the first time, and I will explain why I did not object. Now you have, I think, a flow chart for what the Special Review Board is, and the, yes, that was made by somebody smarter than me, so I'm not even going to try to explain it. But Special Review Board is the first place where somebody who wants to get put into something less restrictive, they have to file a petition, and it is first heard by this special review board, and it's a very informal hearing. And the uproar about this type of case came about recently because of a man named Clarence Opine. I was at Clarence Opine's special review board hearing, and of all the people who talked or chose not to talk at that hearing, there was one person who objected to the provisional discharge plan, and strenuously, and that was me. And I had my reasons at the time. I'll just outline those issues. I had issues about his chemical dependency treatment. I had issues about the provisional discharge plan itself. I had concerns about OSI, or Office of Special Investigations, because the state and DHS is taking over supervision of the sexual predators as they come out into the community. We do not use county mental health case managers because we think that's a different paradigm and would be inappropriate. So why did I oppose his being provisionally discharged at the special review board? Well, besides my uncertainty about his CD issues, as Mr. Benson has just told you, this whole process is new for the MSOP program. So this provisional discharge plan is something that people had to put together out of pretty much plain cloth. And I had issues with it. There were some things about it I didn't like or I didn't think were clear enough. So I made a bit of a stink about that. Office of Special Investigations, they said they had somebody that they were hiring and they were gonna be able to handle it. Well, I didn't know who this person was, and I wanted somebody good. Well, since that time, I found out the guy they were talking about, actually I'm afraid of the guy now. He's an ex-cop with about 35 years of experience, and he spent about a half an hour one day lecturing me and started talking about how one of his jobs in a virtually one-to-one with the patients, not having 15 clients or 30 clients, but maybe one, maybe two clients in all, that part of his job would be covert surveillance. And I'd never heard of such a thing. We certainly don't do that with parolees. We don't do it with people who are released from mental health hospitals. So here's this guy who's going to tag around and in shadows following people. Okay. So as I gathered more information after the special review board hearing, I became convinced that the issues that I had with chemical dependency were not any longer an issue. The provisional discharge plan was modified a little bit, tweaked here and tweaked there, and I got to a point where I thought this is more severe than anything I've ever seen. So I'm happy with it. Certainly with the OSI people, I'm happy with them. as was said to you, when this client was in CPS, he was getting treatment at Project Pathfinders. He will continue to do that, so that is not changing. I reviewed more records, and then we have an opportunity to have an independent psychologist get involved in these cases. And when they get appealed to the Supreme Court Appeal Panel, or SCAP, typically the respondent or patient's attorney gets to name who he wants for a psychologist, as long as the person's on the list. Well, I went to my manager and I said, I don't know who they're going to name, but if they name one of the people that I'm not always fond of, I'm going to want Dr. James Alsdorf to be our retained expert. And I had it all set up with him. Well, it turned out the attorney for the respondent picked Dr. Alsdorf as the independent examiner. So this was the guy that I wanted. And I was involved in that whole process, helping him gather records. I watched as he examined Mr. Opine. And I looked at the testing and went through the results. So that was part of the process that got things changed from the Special Review Board to the Supreme Court Appeal Panel. There were a lot of things that changed, at least in my mind. I also met on a couple of occasions with Commissioner Jessup, and she had her own misgivings about it. She kept saying, well, what about this, what about that? And I answered her questions as best I could, and I told her about Dr. Alsdorf, and we went over stuff. And she can tell you herself what got her to her final conclusion, but I was satisfied at some point along this process, probably a few weeks before the actual SCAP hearing, that this was the right thing to do. The criteria basically for a provisional discharge in the statutes, and it's under 253B.185 and one of the subdivisions. But basically what they're looking at are a couple of things. Number one, can the treatment needs of the client be met in the proposed placement? And I, in my own mind, was comfortable with that. Yes, they could be. Second one, which is more important to me, is does this placement provide a reasonable degree of safety for the public? And that's what I've done. I'm just one of the soldiers out there thinking public safety, and have been for all this time. Now, what happened was the extensive records and Dr. Alsdorf's report was made available to all the parties, and we had conversations back and forth, and at some point I indicated, and with the approval of my office, that I had no objection to this move. I thought it was the right thing to do. I thought he satisfied, and MSOP satisfied, the statutory criteria that I'm required to follow. Respondent's attorney was very pleased with this, but ready to go forward if he had to. And then I learned that the commissioner finally decided that this also was the right thing to do. Now, we then go to the SCAP judges, and I got to tell you that I've never been in front of a finer group of judges in the 36 whatever years that I've been a trial attorney. These three judges, and there's actually a group of six, so any three out of those six are okay with me. These would be the people I'd pick if somebody could give me if there was a fantasy judge game. I would take these folks. And it's mainly because they're smart, they're thoughtful, they're careful, and they're careful about doing the right thing. So they're not going to sign off on something like this unless they're happy with it. But of course, they were supplied the records from the MSOP program. They were supplied with the historical documents from Mr. Oppheim and the examiner's report. Now, I want to bring up one little issue. I've seen in some media stuff that, and it did accurately reflect a piece of the Special Review Board findings, and that was that he still presents as a serious risk to the public. Well, that was taken out of one of the evaluations done of Mr. Oppheim. And, you know, this is a tricky business for psychologists to assess risk in people. They do the best they can, but it's still kind of magic in certain ways. But what they look at for risk factors are, there's two categories. The first is called static risk factors. The second category is called dynamic risk factors. Static risk factors are like, how many convictions do you have for sexual offenses? How many times have you been arrested for selling drugs? How many times have you done this? How many times has this happened? Those static factors are historical, and they will never change. And if people relied only on those static factors would always say, this person is at high risk. And they're so built in that even if the person died just using those factors, they'd still be at high risk. But what they also look at are what are called dynamic factors. And the dynamic factors are the things that have changed. What's changed in this person? What has happened? Who's intervened on him? How? And how well has he responded to that? What has he exhibited during the course of treatment? And those are different things. Well, the Special Review Board relied on the static factors, and they said he remains at high risk. Okay. But that's what happened. And if we were to rely only on static factors, nobody would get out, ever. So the three judges were satisfied between the people indicating they had no objections, and they made their decision based upon the records and the report of the expert examiner, and did not, in this case, rely on testimony. But also, they rely on their own experience and their, I believe, in their trust and their confidence in the people who are appearing in front of them, either the lawyers or the psychologists. They want to know what the experts think, and they factor into that what they think of these experts and what they think of these lawyers. I want to say in closing that in case somebody is thinking, well, wow, you're sitting up there with Dennis Benson and Commissioner Jessen, and so you guys are just kind of a little package deal, and you all hang out together and just, you know, have a good time together. Well, we're here together today, but we weren't together a couple days ago, and I'm afraid next week we're probably not going to be together either. This is, you should take a picture of this, because this is probably not going to happen.
Let the record reflect, nobody on this committee indicated you guys hang together.
So far. What I do want to say that, and even though I don't always agree with the MSOP program, we've had my duke outs with each other. And I've certainly irritated a few people I know as part of the program. But what I have to say is, and I've been involved in this for so long, that what this current program is state of the art. And it's evolved so much in the past 3, 4, 5 years. It's great. And you just need to remember that the people that they're treating are by definition very, very tough to treat. Very tough to treat. So what they're doing is great. And the reason it takes so long is because it's worth it. My business is about public safety, and my cohort that's with me wanted me to say that 3 times, but I think once will satisfy you. So anyway, thank you all for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Whitseth. Commissioner Jessen, welcome to the committee again. If you'd like to introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Cindy Jessen. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. So I just want to talk about my role in provisional discharge and the decision-making process that I went through in this case. I just want to start out by saying that I really look at each of these cases that come before me, and once again, it's not my decision to release people, but I do have to tell the court in these provisional discharge cases, the statutes, the laws you pass require me to say whether I support or oppose provisional discharge. And I look at this very carefully. I read through all the records. I rely on experts. And I talk to the treatment providers, and I do not have a blanket approach. And I just want to start out by noting that the first case where I had to weigh in on was the Ryberg case. And you all may have followed that. That was the first sex offender decision I had to make. after I became commissioner, did I oppose or support his provisional discharge. And this was a case where the SRB, so it's on your little chart that's before you, because you know they first bring their petition, an offender does, to the SRB, and there the SRB recommended granting provisional discharge to Ryberg. My predecessor, Commissioner Ludeman, had objected to that recommendation and petitioned the court to require a hearing, so I kind of came into this a little late in the process, but I wanted to look at everything. I reviewed all the information about the case, including obviously what the SRB had recommended, and I consulted with an expert forensic psychologist, because in that case the court hadn't appointed an independent examiner. So the, as commissioner, following Commissioner Ludeman's lead, we had retained an expert just to give me, you know, advice that was separate from the treatment program's advice, because in the Ryberg case, the treatment MSOP treatment staff had supported provisional discharge, as had the SRB. But I made a decision to oppose that provisional discharge based upon kind of the expert advice I got in my own review of the records. I mean, just so you all know, that hearing ended on January 6th, though we probably don't expect a decision until later in the spring or early summer. In general, how it works is after the special review board makes a decision, and I forward as commissioner its recommendation to the court, and within 30 days of that decision, the SRB decision, either I as commissioner or the county can ask the court for a hearing, you know, or obviously if the SRB rules against the petitioner can ask the court for a hearing. Now, I just want to say, in the vast majority of court cases before the SRB, they recommend denying the petition. And so it's usually the petitioner that asks for the appeal. But where I look closely at these cases is where either the SRB recommends granting petition or whether the treatment team recommends provisional discharge. Because once again, just like the SRB, that is very rare that they recommend provisional discharge. And in these activities, I'm represented by the Attorney General's office. So the next formal decision point in the process after the appeal is made to the Supreme Court Appeals Panel is 3 weeks before the scheduled court hearing, where the parties, and in this case I'm a party, under the statute, under the law, are required to submit a statement of position. And sometimes, because of the way these cases are scheduled, the court hearing is often a year or more after the SRB recommendation is issued. And as in any other court case, and I think some of you all know I'm a lawyer, so kind of I know this, there's a lot of activity that takes place in those weeks and days before the actual hearing. And that activity may, and in this case in Opheim did, actually include the appointment by the court of this independent forensic psychologist, and that psychologist goes and interviews, as Mr. Woodseth has said, the individual, looks at all the records, and also that independent court-appointed psychiatrist also talks with the treatment team. You know, and sometimes in this case, as in this case, I will also consult experts. You know, in the Opheim case, I didn't know if the court was going to appoint an independent examiner or not. And I wanted to have an outside look at this, not because I don't, you know, trust and overall think highly of our treatment team at MSOP, but because I think as commissioner I need that independent voice giving me advice. And in the Ryberg case, that was why we hired an independent expert. And so knowing this case, the Opheim case was scheduled for hearings in early February. In December, I, you know, took the step to hire my own expert. As I said, not sure if the court would or not. So what do I look at when I'm looking at provisional, whether or not I support or oppose provisional discharge? You know, I look at the law, the same thing that same statute that says to these three judges, you know, tells them the criteria they have to apply about whether they agree to grant the provisional discharge petition. That's what I look at too. And so I look and ask myself these factors. Is there any longer a need for treatment and supervision in that current treatment setting? And to me, my shorthand for that, has this client successfully completed treatment? So that's one factor. The second factor is also really important. Do the conditions of the provisional discharge plan provide a reasonable degree of protection to the public, as well as enable the patient to adjust successfully? So you have to look at both of those things. You know, and when I first, and so just moving to the Opheim case for a moment, I had to make that, you know, 20 days before the hearing, make a statement. And that was, I think, on January 13th, I believe. I had to tell the court my position. And what the information I had at that point was I had a treatment team that said they supported provisional discharge. And I had a special review board that said they recommended against provisional discharge. So I, based upon that information, I didn't think it was really clear, very, very clear, that those two criteria were met. But after I made that decision, that, you know, had to make that statement on January 13th, I learned a lot of additional information. I think the most important piece for me was when, and it was like the Tuesday, I remember I got the report the Tuesday before the Friday hearing, I had the report of the independent court-appointed expert forensic psychologist, Dr. Alsdorf. So I've spent a lot of time studying that report. Before then, I'd gone through all the records myself, and so I had a good idea of the basics in the case. But I read that report very carefully. And that evaluation talked about both the fact that progress in treatment, as well as the client's ability to manage his risk factors in the community. And Dr. Alsdorf concluded that he met the provisional discharge statutory criteria and strongly recommended that the court grant provisional discharge, given the discharge plan, the very detailed discharge plan that was before the court. This was an important matter, and I wanted to know more. So as Mr. Witsap said, one of the things I did was I talked to him. You know, George Witseth and I had for a period of time practiced law together in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. And so I knew his background as a prosecutor and his expertise, and so I talked to him. And I wanted his opinion. I wanted his opinion, one, of Dr. Alsdorf, you know, because, you know, what's the depth of his knowledge? Is he the sort of expert that's, you know, always kind of going along with these petitioners? So I talked to him about that, and I talked to him about the county's position. Because this is the county that originally committed him, and they don't commit people civilly unless they have a really good reason, and I really understood the reasons that the county pursued civil commitment in this case. I also spent time again looking at the Special Review Board report from May of 2011. And I not only looked at the review board report, I called the chair of that SRB panel, Mr. Fabian Hoffner, because I wanted to talk to him about this, since the review board had recommended against provisional discharge. Mr. Hoffner said, look, the major thing for us, Cindy, was chemical lack of formal chemical dependency treatment. He'd had it 20 years ago, but he hasn't had it recently, even though he recognized he'd been attending AA meetings regularly. So I went back and looked at the file, talked to the treatment team, and talked to Mr. Hoffner about the fact that after that SRB decision, he started informal CD treatment and outpatient treatment, going regularly to him in Mankato, as well as continuing to attend AA meetings 4 or 5 times a week. The last thing I did was, because I had retained an outside expert, as I said earlier, Dr. David Thornton. And Dr. Thornton, just so you all know, he's nationally recognized in the field of evaluating risk and treatment outcomes for civilly committed sex offenders. He is one, you know, George talked about this static 99, this, you know, that's used to analyze sex offender risk, and he was one of the developers of that. He's currently the treatment director for the Wisconsin Civil Commitment Program, so he has a lot of hands-on experience. And he had reviewed all the records and interviewed the staff and the halfway house staff and the chemical dependency provider that Mr. Alpine had been seeing. And when I talked to him on the phone, I remember after I read the report, what he said was very similar to what Dr. Alsdorf had said. Dr. Thornton gave me some very specific ideas for what do we do, what are the possibilities after the halfway house, and how would that work? And I talked to him, and I think he gave me some real insights into that. But he thought he had successfully completed treatment and overall supported provisional discharge. So With that, I also reviewed the provisional discharge plan. And this plan, as Mr. Whitsett had gone, it was a lot more detailed than some of those original things I had seen. It included housing and supervision plans. I knew that the placement was with Community Reentry Services, which is a halfway a house service provider, and I had previously talked to before we entered in the contract, actually talked to the executive director of that program. It's a program I have confidence in. It's licensed by the Department of Corrections. You know, I looked not only about some of the things Mr. Woodseth had mentioned about the active GPS monitoring, random substance abuse testing, subject to a lot of polygraphs, the day-to-day contact with MSOP folks, also that there's no contact with the victims. And it was important to me that the provisional discharge plan also limited contact with children and other vulnerable adults. I thought that was very important. I mean, there are a lot of other things, and I think that provisional discharge plan is now public. There are 32 parts of it. So I felt more comfortable having looked at and talked to the executive director of that program. I also thought it was very helpful that if there are any changes to those 32 conditions, that provisional discharge plan, to make any changes, you have to go back to court to get to, before you make those changes. The program can't just make those changes on its own. He has to petition the special review board, and once again, I have an opportunity to either to object if I don't think that those changes are appropriate. And there's also really a kind of a hair trigger revocation threat hanging over Mr. Opine under state law if he fails to comply with an order to return to custody. It's a felony level offense. And also I was heartened by the fact that last year the legislature, all of you, passed a change to the provisional discharge law, and Mr. Benson knows it better than I do. But it really, if we see a problem, we can bring him back into MSOP quickly. I must say that my recommendation, even with all of that, to not oppose, didn't support. I was like Mr. Woodseth. I wasn't going to oppose provisional discharge. The court's decision whether or not to provisionally discharge one. But even so, it was not an easy decision. You know, I'm the mother of four. I live in St. Paul. My husband and children always joke about the fact that they would screen me from going to movies where bad things happen to small children. And this is about a provisional discharge of a man who's done horrific things to small children. As a lawyer, I know how to apply the facts, including this expert reports and those treatment recommendations, to apply the facts to the law, the laws that you passed. And I feel that's what I did here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner Jessen. Members, I have a list. Representative Vabler, Representative Benson, Representative Barrett, Quam, Mack, Grunhagen, and Kiffmeyer in that order. And again, I want to thank the testifiers for your testimony and Representative Abler.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the depth of testimony. And it's a lot of content. And I've had the privilege of serving now in my 14th year here. When you've discussed this topic, I think every one of those 14 years. I've learned a lot going from knowing nothing about it to what I do know. And I. What I knew coming into today is the commissioner I knew would not do something lately. I've gotten to know you in the past year and have a lot of regard. I didn't know Mr. Woodseth, and I'd be afraid to have him for a prosecutor, I think. But I was impressed with his thoroughness. I know Mr. Benson from his work in the past, and I was really kind of compelled by the depth of the work that you've done and the sincere decision. As a policymaker, I'm hoping that there's somebody that we can graduate from the program who can be successful, and I pray to God that he's successful and causes no harm. And it's something to celebrate if it can work. It's scary, but I think it's time. And I am comfortable with the decision of the panel up there, the two people that have the decisions to make, and I know it's risky for them. But I appreciate you doing that. Don't have the privilege of reading all the stuff you read. And I appreciate the static versus dynamic. I didn't know that idea. That's helpful to me. I read the static stuff, and I'm like, holy cow. The people, we do. We are a state that believes in rehabilitation. People do, this is pretty bad rehabilitation to go from horrific to being out. But we do believe in that in this state. And the people do a lot of things that they would never do again, and I appreciate your doing that. I just have two questions. Can somebody tell me, one criticism that came from your both your decisions is that because you didn't oppose it, then the SCAP committee just blinked it through. Can you give me a hint of what kind of deliberation they would have done to make their own decision? Can somebody mention that, please?
Mr. Whitseth.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, you've heard to some depth the decision-making process that I went through, with my office, and what Commissioner Jessen went through with all the folks that she works with. And so, first of all, I would preface my remarks by saying that last thing I want is for this to not work, because this is my reputation too, and I've worked hard for my reputation as Commissioner Jessen, as has the MSOP program. So none of us do it lightly. I can tell you for a fact that the three judges who were involved, I could have had this tied up with a bow and had a marching band bring it in, and they would have still scrutinized everything. I don't want to take away from the fact that I've worked with these judges for years now, and I believe that they have a level of confidence in the work that I do. But they will not sign off on anything unless they themselves are assured that this is the right thing to do. These judges also have reputations and not to mention elections to worry about, so they did not take this lightly, and I know that for a fact.
All right, thank you. And I know people have other questions. I'll just, maybe I'll just drop my question, just have a final comment for now. Maybe I'll say something later. But it sounds like 18 years ago or whenever this started, it was not a very good program, and it's a whole different program now. And I hope this is the first of many people who can graduate and can move through and be successful in Minnesota. We spent a lot of money on this program, and I'm glad we can get some result of it. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Vabler. I would like to ask one question, maybe just to add to kind of the tail end of the presentation, and it may help answer some questions or spur others, but the actual process now as this is coming forward, I think people want to understand, I know I do, how this person now is going to be moving out into the community, what notification may be given to the neighborhood, that sort of thing. Can you walk us through the process now? Going forward, what may happen and what's going to happen next?
Mr. Chair and members,
Mr. Benson.
Again, this is our first one, but the law is pretty clear about 15 days. It can't happen sooner than 15 days from the date that the order was issued. So approximately 15 days from the date that the order was issued, we would move the individual to the halfway house, and we would have a meeting with halfway house staff. We would go over all of the elements in the provisional discharge plan. His reintegration agent would be present. We would probably have someone from our Office of Special Investigations present. We are paying for additional casework services at the halfway house because this is our first case. The clinical individual that has been following this individual would be present, and we will have our first staffing with this individual once he gets to the halfway house, making sure that the rules, regulations, his responsibilities are all very clear to him. He would be escorted there. Every time he leaves that halfway house, he will be escorted for the foreseeable future. As indicated, he will be on GPS monitoring. Every visit will be logged. Every phone call will be logged. If he starts to interview for jobs or employment, that will be a part of the record. His outpatient treatment will continue. He'll be escorted from that. He will be subject to urinalysis from time to time, and he will ultimately be subject to additional polygraph exams from time to time during his halfway house stay. The reintegration agent who works for our program will be at the halfway house daily for minimally 30 to 60 days, and that will be the only individual on his or her caseload. So in terms of my experience with the Department of Corrections, we all heard stories about agents who have caseloads of 100. This is a dream opportunity for proper reintegration because we are really going to be hands-on. We are going to be managing his every movement for a period of time. We have to remember, and we don't do that just because we are concerned. We do that because this individual and most of our people have been confined for many, many years. They haven't had that opportunity to walk down a street or unescorted. So we're moving very, very slowly and cautiously and in a way that is consistent with best practice for somebody who has been confined for such a lengthy period of time. As the commissioner mentioned, all of the 32 elements or provisions of that provisional discharge plan have to be followed. We can't change the plan unless we want to repetition the court on his behalf, or if he does it, then we can change an address if we want to. But I can tell you that in terms of community notification is triggered once he would leave the halfway house, but that is a law enforcement responsibility. That is not a program responsibility. The community notification statute is very clear about that. What we did do a couple of years ago is we tweaked that statute so that everybody leaving our program, regardless of whether or not they were a level 3, would be treated as a level 3 with respect to community notification. So that would ultimately occur once he gets to a point where it's time to leave the halfway house setting.
So just so I understand and that I'm clear about this, because there have been some questions about this, under the provisional discharge process that you just described, there is no requirement for neighborhood notification?
As long as, Mr. Chair and members, my understanding of the statute is as long as he's going to a licensed halfway house that provides treatment, that the statute does not trigger community notification until they leave, the individual would go to another address.
So that's assuming the provisional discharge is over and we're at the, what would be the last step, and somebody would be out in the community on their own, correct?
Mr. Chair, he will remain on provisional discharge when he ultimately leaves the halfway house. In my opinion, I think it would be highly unusual if anybody would ever be fully discharged in the foreseeable future anyway. There would be no reason to fully discharge anybody. So we will always have some kind of control over what he does, where he lives, for probably the remainder of his life. So full discharge is way, way out in the future.
Is there any provision for community notification as he moves to the halfway house? I think that's one of the questions that's out there. Is there any way that can be done? Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and members, the law does not provide for it now. That is a policy issue. We are following the law. It is a statute that the Department of Corrections put in place several years ago, at least a decade and a half ago, been around a long time. And the rationale at the time in the DOC was they are under such tight scrutiny at that point, and we know where they are. I mean, it's going to be no secret where our people are for that initial step out of MSOP. Seems more important that that process start when they leave that very controlled setting.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for Mr. Benson and the Commissioner. In your previous testimony, Mr. Benson, I you alluded to that there was a time about 2 or 3 years ago that you felt that the way we were moving, that there was going to be a test case. There was going to be someone or individuals who would get to a point where we'd have to consider release. And I wonder, my question is, did that play into an actual selection, if you will, of a best case scenario, an example of an individual such as who we're talking about now to kind of fit that?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we can honestly tell you again, we don't decide who goes out. That is a court-driven process. The individual clients can determine when they want to petition for provisional discharge. We don't control that either. What we do control is their progress in treatment. And as the commissioner mentioned, many, many of these cases that they petition for provisional discharge, our treatment team says, no, you're not ready. You haven't reached maximum treatment completion at this point. We are always concerned about litigation. I think we have we've had lots of conversation about the constitutionality question, but it certainly doesn't drive our decision making or compromise our thinking around our responsibility to public safety. Those are two separate and distinct issues and certainly considerations. We want to keep this program constitutional, and from a perspective of conditions of confinement, we do everything we can to meet the constitutional standard that we believe we have to meet. We provide the best treatment that we possibly can so that somebody does have an opportunity to reduce their risk, their dynamic factors, to a point where a court might say we are ready. But again, we could never fix that, and we certainly haven't. I think, again, it's a fair question, but it is certainly something that isn't a consideration of the program.
Representative Benson.
Yeah. I have a second follow-up question, but I would like for the commissioner to also answer the question.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson. Now, I don't have as much time at the departments. I've only been in this job a year and 1 month. I certainly support what Mr. Benson has said. He has more history with this than I do. But I would say, I certainly have not been aware of any selection of a best case, and I would say, actually, that the first person who came up for provisional discharge was John Ryberg, whose provisional discharge I opposed, and I opposed that. That was certainly, if you were going to choose a best case, that would have been a very bad choice, which reinforced to me that this is really about who's petitioning, not the MSOP trying to position a best case.
Okay. Representative Benson?
The question was about Mr. Opine, but that's I'll take your word that it didn't factor in. The last one is for you, though, and that is I worked in a large organization for a number of years, and one of the things that you kind of got used to is you never surprise the boss. And in this whole process, I'm wondering where, as you communicated with the governor's office about undoubtedly this being the first case and the high profile and so on, and what kind of guidance did you get from the governor's office on the whole issue?
Commissioner Jessen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, in both my decision to oppose the Ryberg provisional discharge and my decision to not oppose the Opine provisional discharge, I sat down with the governor and told him, briefed him on this, told him what I planned to do, and he supported my decisions in both cases.
Representative Benson?
No, that's good. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Barrett.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Jessen, I'd like to talk to you about the process that was in place here, and then generally speaking, someone presented a graph here that shows it starts with the Special Review Board and three people. And especially in this case, I guess my first question is, was the decision to not recommend release, was that a unanimous decision, or was that not a unanimous decision in this case?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, I believe it was a unanimous decision, but can I defer to Mr. Whitsett since he was there at the SRB hearing?
Sure.
Mr. Whitsett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I would just say after people make their presentations at Special Review Board, the board kicks everybody out, and then they make their decision. And I would note in the order of the Special Review Board, it is only signed by the chair, who was Fabian Hoffner. I'm assuming it probably was unanimous, but I don't know for a fact.
Okay.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner or the other testifier. Now, it leads into my second question, which is, who is involved in that process? You mentioned people being kicked out, which is a good transition into my main thought here. Who is involved in that process, both at the SRB level, and I'll just jump ahead to the various stages here, with the court appeal panel? Who's involved in that as well? And then I do have a follow-up to that question.
Sure. Mr. Whitsett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative. At the Special Review Board, the three board members, as the flowchart indicates, it's chaired by an attorney, there's a psychiatrist, and then a third person, a mental health professional. They do this as a sort of an avocation. The people who are involved in this, the commissioner's office is not involved. The attorney general's office is not involved. It's basically my office from Hennepin County, and we make sure that we're present for all cases that involve Hennepin County, either as county of commitment or as county of financial responsibility. Those aren't always the same, and I won't get into the stuff about that. But anyway, so I'm always present at those hearings. Usually they are conducted by ITV, and there will be various treatment staff who will be making presentations from the MSOP facility. One of the risk assessors will probably speak, and also a member of the treatment team. Also from the facility by ITV is typically the patient and patient's attorney.
Representative Barrett.
And then a follow-up to that, if I could. Thank you, Mr. Whitsett. A lot of material is presented there, including treatment records, sexual violence, risk assessments. It sounds like it's a pretty thorough process that evolved into a decision not to recommend. Then it proceeds further, and there's an appeal. And if the Department of Human Services objects, there would be a hearing. Was there a hearing in this case? And is that hearing open to the public? And has there been hearings in the past? And what has been the process for a hearing, and who's involved in that as well?
Mr. Whitsett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Barrett. If I understand your question correctly, following the Special Review Board, what happens? What happens as a result of the decision of the Special Review Board, the party who is not satisfied with that decision can file an appeal, and then that matter is placed before the Supreme Court appeal panel. But one thing I would note to you, and you don't have access to all this, so I hope you'll take my word for it, but whereas there was some language in the materials presented to the Special Review Board that certainly spoke negatively of Mr. Opheim, the bottom line of all the Mr. Opheim, the bottom line of all the reports was actually quite positive. There was no report that at the very end said this is a huge mistake. All of the reports said, despite what his history is and despite what these static risk factors show, we believe that he's done this and this and this, and that a move is appropriate at this time.
Just one quick follow-up. Sure, thank you. Maybe I should have asked my question a different way. In this situation with Clarence Opheim, was there a hearing that happened before the Supreme Court appeal panel issued their findings and their order?
What I can tell you, thank you, Mr. Chair, sorry, and Representative Barrett. What happened was on the Friday when the hearing was scheduled, all parties were present. There were witnesses present. The independent examiner was present. There were documents filed with the Supreme Court appeal panel. There were also discussions in chambers. And we then came out, put everything on the record in a formal manner, and made some dissertations. I probably made the longest one because I wanted the record to be clear. First of all, the fact that I had objected to this move at the Special Review Board, and secondly, that I had changed my position and that this was the new position of my office, that I was no longer opposing it. And then I did lay out my reasons for the change. So as far as a formal hearing in the sense of was there testimony taken, no, there was not. But there was a record made and there were many exhibits filed. The packet of exhibits is probably an inch to an inch and a half thick.
Mr. Chair, if I could just one more follow-up question.
Sure.
And what I'm trying to get at is whether people who weren't involved in the Special Review Board or weren't involved in the typical Supreme Court appeal panel had an opportunity to address their concerns at a hearing. Sounds like they didn't because there was no objection by the Department of Human Services. So I'm trying to understand who all was involved in the process and who might have been involved had there been a hearing. And don't know how to quite articulate that, but if you could answer that, and if you don't understand, I can ask again in a different way. And I don't mean that in any negative sense, but I'm not sure I'm articulating this accurately.
No, I think...
Mr. Witsa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Barrett. It sounds to me like what you're saying is if there was a member of the public who wanted to address a concern, could they have done so? These matters are not posted anywhere that, hey, on Friday, February 6th, there's going to be a hearing on Clarence Alpine versus the commissioner, and if you want to speak, you are invited. There's nothing like that that happens. I've never actually seen anything like that happen. People who are involved in the case, who have some connection to the case, are notified. And those people were all present. We had lawyers from the Attorney General's office. And I was there. The examiner was there. But it is not, I have not ever seen in the 16 years or so that I've been doing this where a member of the public came forward. There are typical, and typical to these situations, there are victim notifications available, and I believe MSOP program and also my office do the best we can to contact victims. However, I used to do child sexual abuse cases, and there were times where we would approach a family, and them coming to court was more difficult than them not knowing what happened. And that was even when a case was fresh. You got to remember that Mr. Alpine's last offense, I believe, was around 1988, which means that's 23 years ago. And what we try not to do is bring up old ghosts in people's lives unless we need to. We do have occasionally victims who will stay in contact with our office, and then we do make sure that they are notified of all these hearings and invite their presence and invite their input. And there are ways for them to have input, but that is a very rare circumstance.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barrett. I just want to remind members we've got about a half hour, a little under a half hour now, and we have nine people lined up, and I think Representative Abler wanted a closing comment too. So we will go to Representative Kwan, then we have Mack, Grunhagen, Kiffmeyer, Liebling, Hosh, McDonald, and Allen. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank the testifiers. This is not an easy topic. Doesn't matter where you're sitting around this table, you can see that it's not a fun, easy topic. I'm just trying to understand so that when my constituents or neighbors or community members ask about this, I understand that some of the history and can answer. And now, my understanding is that back around the time of the early 90s, Representative Bishop and others authored some, the Sexual Dangerous Persons Act and Community Notification Act, and that was sort of in response to the state Supreme Court releasing Lineham and Rickmeyer, and that, you know, that's what sort of set things in place, and that this whole process that you're delineating has dedicated people making the best decision within the law and the structure that we have. I also sympathize with the chair on notification, you know, because I think it we should have something there, and I'm guessing quite a few people around this table are looking at how to generate a bill to take care of that. The biggest thing I have gotten so far is, you know, with about 100 separate offenses, about 30 different victims, you know, that's just a few months per offense. Being able to understand just, you know, why it is as it is. Now, you've mentioned the constitutionality of it, and if we're going to have a program, we've got to have, if we truly have a program, there is an output. And I understand that. Out of this, can we improve? Do you have any suggestions to us to improve this process? You know, justice is blind, and past offenses don't come into whether they're through the program or not. But my difficulty is, first of all, I'm glad that I don't have to review what you have to review in this process. But my difficulty is, how do I, you know, explain this? Because unless you, you know, have seen that in the details, I think it's hard to put the words. So I just want that help so I can communicate better to the people that come to me.
And maybe some assurances about the safety aspect. Right, Representative Quam. Who'd like to take that first? Commissioner Jessen?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I mean, thank you for the statements and the comments. And maybe I'll take a first shot at this and then ask my colleagues if they want to add to it. You know, as far as your question about notification, I mean, I think that's a very good, I think those are very good questions. You know, the Supreme Court Appeals Panel hearing, I believe, is a public hearing. You know, but I think, you know, just this makes us say, are there things we should do to, you know, to make this more, to make people more aware of that? You know, so I think those are good questions. Right, we are today trying to follow the law as it is, but I think that's very understandable that you would raise those, think about those things. As far as the constitutionality of the program, if I can say two things. One, I mean, we really do want to work to improve this program. And, you know, I think the Office of Legislative Auditors report last year laid out, which actually, you know, in our MSOP program had already made some of those recommendations, but we really endorse a lot of those changes. And we think those would be very good changes to make to the program overall, that would make it be for, have fewer people coming, maybe alternatives for some of the people who otherwise go into this very expensive program, but where there's still treatment and there's still security and looking out for public safety. So I think that that's a very good starting place. And I know a number of people on a bipartisan basis in the legislature are thinking about that as well, which we're trying to work with them. But I want to just be clear, as far as my decision not to oppose the provisional discharge in this case, it was, while I'm all about trying to improve the program, I did not think about the constitutionality of the program when I was making the decision on this case. I just looked at applying the law to the facts in this situation. You know, that my thoughts about, my concerns about the constitutionality of the program, what we need to do to improve it, I set aside. Because I don't think that's the way to make decisions when we're deciding who to release from the program. But understanding that we do have to make those decisions so that we improve our program so that people have that potential to be released into the community. So, Mr. Chair, I don't know if others want to add to that.
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and members, I think the other suggestion that I would have is that we continue to have a rational dialogue about this highly charged, sensitive topic. It is much bigger than the 635 people at MSOP. Sexual violence in the state of Minnesota and in the nation is overwhelming. And there are numbers out there that are chilling in terms of just how big this iceberg really is. 85% of the cases go unreported or uncharged or unconvicted or are dropped. So we're dealing with the 2 to 2.5% of sex offenders that we know about in the state of Minnesota. Imagine if that 85% dropped to 50%. We'd have an MSOP that would be five times as large as the one we have, probably. So, again, as we continue that rational dialogue, I think we really have to look further upstream too, and we are one cog in the wheel of managing sexual violence in Minnesota. We need to get back to awareness. We need to get back to education. Early intervention, I think, is key, getting in there quicker so that we don't manufacture these monsters that have 100, 200 victims out there. Incarceration, good treatment, research-based, best practices treatment. We believe that treatment does impact positively on recidivism. There's research out there that shows that now. There wasn't 10, 15 years ago. And strong, strong supervision on the way out. That is a proven piece of the process that is absolutely critical. There are parallels, and we always hesitate to bring it up because it touches so many nerves, but there are parallels between chemical dependency treatment and follow-up supervision or involvement, and that's the success. People that go through a 30-day program have a limited opportunity of success. People that go through and work their program, have the wraparound services, have a much, much higher incidence of success. And it's not a lot different with sex offenders. Put them through treatment and dump them into Hennepin County or Ramsey County without those wraparound services, I think we're going to be pretty disappointed. But if we continue to develop this reintegration model and help them succeed, because it's in our best interest to help them succeed, and it's difficult. It's difficult to get your arms around why are we doing this with these people that have this horrendous history. Well, we're sort of stuck with what we have right now. But the one thing we all can do is, again, go further upstream and just begin to have that conversation. And if there's a dime or two, prevention needs some dollars too. Europe is doing some very interesting things around that. So that's what I would suggest.
Thank you, Mr. Benson. Representative Quam, I think we're going to move on to Representative Mack, if that's okay. Very good. Representative Mack.
Two brief questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first one, Commissioner Justin, I appreciate your comments on making your decision based on the facts that were in front of you and the thoughts that went into that. And I have just one question, and I don't know if you're able to answer this question. I understand if you're not. But we have in front of us a letter here from Governor Dayton that was in response to some concerns brought forth by House leadership. And it's an informative letter. He's very clear on many of the points, and I think it's helpful to understanding his thoughts on this issue. My one question is, it's like third to last paragraph, where he talks about the previous administration was able to keep all of these individuals confined indefinitely and avoid these extremely difficult decisions. In light of the aforementioned litigation, my administration does not have that option. And he mentions the litigation prior regarding possibly the constitutionality of this program. My question for you, and again, it's the governor's signature on this letter. I'm just wondering if you can shed any light on his statement, my administration does not have that option. If you can just give some thought behind what that means for us here at the legislature and where the governor's possibly coming from on that statement.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack. Just to give you a little background on the some of the challenges on the legal side, that there is a case pending in federal court. It's in its early stages. It's a class action that we think likely will challenge the constitutionality of the civil commitment based on the past failure to successfully reintegrate anyone into the community. It's got the attention of the federal courts, and so we're concerned about that, despite the fact that we are very confident in the treatment that we're providing. I think that I certainly, based on my discussions with the governor, do not believe in any way the governor was saying, okay, because of this, we need to release someone. That is not what the governor was saying to me. The governor listened to what I was doing, understood it, and supported my decision, which is not based on a constitutional challenge. I think what the governor is saying is that all of us collectively need to be concerned about this constitutional threat. And so we need to look, you know, that we can't just say, keep them in forever. But that doesn't mean we need to say, so let's let a lot of people out or let a certain number out. We still have to make very individualized decisions. And I know the governor recognized that. And I think supported my approach, and that's my approach.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Commissioner Jessen. That is helpful in understanding it's an extremely complicated situation on all sides. My only other very brief question is when it comes to the issue of, and I don't know who this is best directed at, but the victims of, in this case, this gentleman who will possibly be released. My question is, you know, I don't know who the victims are in this particular case, but if it is someone that the Mr. Oheim, a family member, something like that, one of his previous victims, is there a provision in his discharge? Is it somewhere in statute that I don't know where any contact, any attempted contact, anything of that nature? I'm just wondering what protections are in place for victims, particularly victims that may be related to or live in the county where they're being released in. I don't know if there's any type of separation, how many miles they have to be away from a victim or anything like that. But any information would be helpful.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack. Well, a couple of things about that. First of all, let me say that we notify any victims of these hearings and of these discharges. There were no victims that asked to be notified in this case, as opposed to the Ryberg case, where there were victims at the hearing and that wanted to be involved. But yes, are the provisional discharge plan itself in number 11 says Mr. Oheim shall not have a relationship or contact with any past victims without prior approval from the reintegration specialist. It also goes further than that, really, to prohibit him from being in places, knowing many of his previous victims were young, from places with children, places with other vulnerable adults. And to get any of this changed in this provisional discharge plan, once again, he would have to go back and get court approval for that. So we are trying to pay particular attention to that.
Okay, Representative Grimhagen, then Kiffmeyer, Liebling, Hosh, McDonald, and Allen. We have 10 minutes.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Grimhagen.
Thank you to the testifiers also. I especially want to thank Mr. Woodsith for your, if I pronounce that correctly, for your efforts to put people that in crimes that you've dealt with behind the bars and protect the safety of our citizens, state of Minnesota. I wouldn't want your job, but I appreciate people like you that you're willing to do it. I did do 13 years at jail ministry. I just want to be clear, jail ministry. I wasn't in jail, okay, just jail ministry. They let me out every Sunday night, okay? Unsupervised, by the way. But anyway, back to the point. What I draw from this is that based on our best efforts, and I appreciate all the efforts and safeguards that you've gone through, all three of you, and the best technology and state-of-the-art that we have, there is still a subjective element to this release that none of us can predict in terms of the safety of our citizens. Agreed?
Who wants to take that one? Mr. Woodsith.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam,
I got your name wrong. That's okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, you're right next to Representative Quam. yes, in a word.
Okay.
It
quickly, because there's other subjective. People want to. Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative
Grimhagen. Okay, my point is this. To the citizens and state, to the people around this table, and in general, There's people in this program, several hundred people. We can't change that. I understand we have to follow the law. I understand what the governor's saying. I understand the testimony. But it doesn't have to continue to be like this. We can change the law. We can take people like this, and I'm sorry, I believe in rehabilitation. I believe in forgiveness. But that doesn't mean you remove the consequence. This person, in my opinion, should have a law. We should have a law in the state. Locked up for life, no chance of parole, and or the death penalty. End of consequence, okay? You can do things down to 8-year-old children that they carry for the rest of their life. You have nixed your right to freedom in this state, okay? So we can change this. I hope we can do it on a bipartisan basis. But there's a rep at the table here who's having a bill drafted to put these people life behind bars, no chance of parole. Again, we cannot change the people in the pipeline, but we can quit feeding people into this program. I'm sorry, no matter how well intended, there's always going to be a subjective part to this program. Let us err on the side of the protection of the women and children in this state rather than on the criminals and the predators that prey upon them. And I hope that you could get behind such a bill and testify in support of it. Final question, could you support legislation that would change the law to life in prison with no chance of parole for people such as this and or the death penalty? Just yes or no, very quickly.
Well, Representative Grunhagen, when we're talking about the process in this particular instance, you've gone way beyond that, but if somebody wants to respond to that, you're welcome to. All right, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just think that the point made in that subjective risk, I think that's got to be a tremendous weight upon you and responsibility, and you have communicated that. I've seen that you've taken it diligently. I do think, though, that I have a concern here with the governor's letter, and that is because it implies that you might have made Mr. Benson, that you might have made a political decision to help the governor avoid some extremely difficult decisions, that you kept all of these individuals confined indefinitely. And I don't think that reflects well in that statement. I mean, I think I would believe that you, if someone that you thought was ready sooner, you would have gone through that process. You wouldn't have just kept them there to help somebody else avoid a difficult decision. And I just thought it would be fair to give you an opportunity, Mr. Benson, to just respond to that, because I don't think that fairly reflects, I think, what the MSOP program does.
Mr. Benson?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, unlike the commissioner, I had no conversation with the governor on this issue. I can tell you, and I've told committees before, that when this program started to grow very dramatically, it went through lots of changes. The primary focus was just where are we going to put them all, and then developing subsequent treatment, and then keeping treatment directors. The program went through, I believe, 5 clinical directors in the last 10 or 11 years. So there were problems, operational problems, inside of the program. We have since stabilized that. So I think there were multiple reasons why the program got off to a slow start because of the dramatic growth. I remind people that I was the deputy in corrections when the population doubled in 5 years, and that's a tough thing to deal with. So I don't necessarily... I can't speak for the governor. I guess that's kind of the bottom line, and I'm not going to try. I think the commissioner had more personal contact, but there were multiple issues in play with respect to why the process took a fair number of years. But I also have been saying that, you know, we had, as more and more people went to community preparation service, sooner or later there's going to be one that certainly our clinical executive clinical team is going to say, this person is ready. He's reached maximum improvement. He's ready for consideration, and we would support a petition.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Benson. I think it wasn't, I was just asking for your, not anybody else's, but just for you. You've explained it well, that the fact that we are here today, just a matter of a series of years of situations and circumstances that put us in a situation of today, that you wouldn't have pushed anything earlier because it wasn't ready to be done earlier. And I think that's a fair representation of how the MSOP program does it, just a circumstance that occurred today. I think, though, as carrying the MSOP bill last year, and we had unanimous support, carrying another bill this year, I think our legislature is showing our willingness to work in a bipartisan way with bipartisan authors, to respond to you in the agency, to assist you in, again, taking those year-upon-year steps that we are doing. I do think, though, that there was a comment here that the governor seems to be waiting for some bill to be introduced, and I know there's been some effort along that way, but I do know that you've also brought bills forward, or the governor has brought bills forward, or our ideas forward, to also deal with issues as exemplified by last year and this year as those bills have come. So I would like to know in this particular case, Commissioner Jessen, that rather than just kind of, I think we have legislative initiatives that we are doing, but do you as a commissioner, some of the work with other legislators, intend to bring forward legislation this year yet that would maybe deal in a broader way on this subject?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, you know, first, we really do appreciate working with you last year on the MSOP bills, and I think there were several other health matters as well, and appreciate your leadership on that. The actually, we introduced two MSOP bills, have been introduced, I believe, this year, you know, and one of them deals with asking for a study for a stay of commitment to deal with some of those front-end issues so that we could kind of have more tools so people don't have to go into the program. Our idea is there, you know, which follows up on one of the legislative auditor's suggestions. We asked for a study rather than just immediately doing it because it would take some time to get this in place. And we really want, and we're hoping that the legislature would be, you know, by help signifying they want us to do that, that would be a step forward. We are also we've also working on scheduling more of these, working with the court administration to do more SCAP scheduling, and another thing we're trying to do to further the legislative auditor's reports. We've also been working, and I really want to thank our MSOP staff for working very closely with Senator Limmer. I met with him about this just a week and a half ago, as well as Representative Cornish, who I know that they are working on kind of looking at some a bill to address a number of these issues. They've been out meeting with us, talking with folks in our facilities. I know Senator Hand's also been involved in this. So we've been trying to give advice and to talk with them and help them with this. I don't, you know, I don't know where they will end up. We've been talking with them about their drafts. But, you know, as the governor, I think in his letter, you know, suggested, we would really very much like to work on this in a bipartisan basis.
Thank you, Commissioner.
All right. Representative Liebling, we are going to go 5 minutes over. Members will go to 4:20 because this is important and a number of people have questions. Let's keep it down to one question if we can per person. Then we have session at 4:30. So, Representative Liebling.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifiers. I think a lot of what I wanted to address, I think, has been addressed. I had to step out briefly during the hearing, but you know, I just wanted to really make sure, I know it's been discussed a lot, but I just for the public, that people understand that the people who are in your program are not serving a sentence. I think that's really important for people to distinguish because obviously if the program is unconstitutional, then we're in a world of hurt. You know, I mean, these are people that we bipartisanly, we all want to be successful and careful, and we're all concerned about the safety of the community, but the reality is these are people who are not under a sentence. And so if this isn't real treatment, then we don't have the right to be holding them at all. And I guess I just wanted Mr. Widseth, I appreciate so much that you're here talking about this, and I want to echo that I appreciate the work you do, and I'd just like to hear your comment on that, just so that the public is really clear about this.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Witsa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. I took Representative Grunhagen's remarks to heart, and I want you to know that for all these years that I've been doing this business, I see these guys. Thank God we have a civil commitment statute, because when I first started, when there were the sentencing guidelines started, first-degree criminal sexual conduct called for a guideline sentence of 43 months, which means you would do 27 months for the most horrendous type of rape. 27 months, and then you're out. Talk about catch and release. And so we have found a way to incapacitate people who have over and over again shown that they are not safe in the public domain. So we have them incapacitated, and the reason we do that is, number one, to keep them away from women and children, and number two, to give them treatment. But it is not a criminal sentence. Their sentences have all long expired, and but for this statute, they would be out. So we have this statute, and the statute only withstands constitutional scrutiny if we provide treatment. And treatment means people get better and they get released. If we fake it and just say, well, we're kind of pretending that we have treatment, but we're never going to release anybody, this will be gone. And it's like you say, world of hurt. This I don't know how to say something bigger than world of hurt, a universe of hurt. Let's just open the doors and turn them loose and then just see what happens. And that would be awful. What they're doing at this program is terrific, but it is treatment, and it's designed to have an end when the people are ready. So, yeah, we'd all like to go out. I can't tell you the number of times I thought about how can I take care of this guy if he doesn't get convicted. And I had my own ideas, and I never acted on them. That's why I'm still here. But it hits us all in the gut. It hits us all in the gut when you read these histories. So I hope that answers your question. And I thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd first like to just start off with you, Mr. Chair, in the hearing and the respectful atmosphere that we've had today. I mean, this is a politically supercharged environment on an issue that probably makes us all think of our loved ones, our wives, our husbands, and children, and it's unimaginable. So I think the hearing's gone well, and I've learned a tremendous amount, Mr. Woodseth, Commissioner Jessen, Mr. Benson. We've always had hearings about the cost and the growth of MSOP, but not about the process of a provisional discharge. So I've learned a tremendous amount and learned about the burden of responsibility that you all carry. And it's one I'm glad I don't have to carry, although as a legislator, we all do. We do know that the law as we have it set up was followed under this circumstance, and that's important to note. And it's also important to note that this person did not get released. I've heard that word a few times. This person is not released. It is under the constant supervision of the program and is a provisional discharge. And I think we need to always understand that. Representative Quam, I think you had the best question of the day. Do you have any suggestions on how to make this process better? We have to learn from the experts, and you are the experts. And I hope you share your ideas and suggestions to us, because that's what will develop a bipartisan effort to make sure that the public is safe and we maintain the constitutionality of this program. So I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Chair, and this was a learning experience, and I appreciate the time that we had.
Thank you, Representative Hosh. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question. I'm reading an audit from the Office of the Legislative Auditor from March of 2011 regarding the civil commitment about sex offenders. According to their findings, they found that the Minnesota Sex Offenders Treatment Program has experienced frequent leadership changes, which, Mr. Benson, you mentioned that, significant staff vacancies, and has struggled to maintain the type of therapeutic environment necessary for treating the high sex offenders. Goes on to say that the current MSOP management has worked to address security problems and clinical deficiencies, but it still needs to increase the number of treatment hours provided, improve the therapeutic environment and establish clear guidelines for judging the treatment progress. Some of the key recommendations is from that the Department of Human Services should require that MSOP to provide more treatment hours per week than are currently provided. Several key factors explain why the MSOP clients have been discharged from the program, and I'll pose the question after this last statement. First, problems in the treatment program over the last 10 years have likely affected the progress of some key sex offenders. So my question is that after the legislative auditor's report just a year ago next month, have you instilled all of their suggestions to that they suggested that now you can say that it's okay to let this gentleman go? Or I won't, let me restate that he's no gentleman, this fella. That's Mr. Opine.
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, to the extent that we had the resources and the time, yes, we have made, I think, significant progress on number of treatment hours. We have hired over 30 clinicians in the last 12 months. We have provided state-of-the-art training. We are prepared to offer treatment to any civilly committed sex offender who wants to engage. Our treatment participation, again, has gone from about 50% 6 years ago up to 85 to 87% today. We think we have a treatment protocol that is grounded in research and best practices.
Thank you, Mr. Benson. Representative Allen, and then we do have to make a correction quickly to the minutes, and then we've got to get to session. So, Representative Allen.
Mr. Chair, I'll keep it brief. I just have that one comment. It's along the lines of Representative Hosh's comments, that this, I mean, the language used in some outside of this hearing, we talk, is that this individual is being released. Or, and then the third paragraph from the end in Governor Dayton's letter is somewhat unfortunate that's in here. I mean, it sort of implies that the previous administration somehow circumvented the petition and hearing process, and I don't know if that that was necessary to, because this is not a political process, and I think the process that set out here in the petition and hearing process was a very long process, a very deliberate process, and it was governed by statute on what you were to consider, and that it is not a release; it is a provisional discharge. And at some point, I mean, it doesn't sound like there's going to even be a point where there will be a discharge. But at some point, if there is a discharge, it will follow. It will not come at your initiation. It will come at the offender. The will petition. Will have to petition, and then they will go through this whole process again. And then at that point he would be released into. It would be correct to say that he's being discharged or released into the community. And then at that point, then we have a whole other body of the statute, I'm sure, that governs how he's released in the notice. And so I just wanted to say that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Allen. Representative Allen, would you like to, I'm going to mention some corrections here we need to make to the minutes, and if you would entertain the motion to make the corrections, I'd appreciate it. We need to change in the minutes from February 14th, it says 2011, it needs to be changed to 2012, and as much as I miss him, Representative Hayden is no longer on the committee, so we need to strike his name from the attendance list. If you'd be willing to make the motion.
I make the motion.
Very good. Representative Allen makes the motion to correct the minutes in that manner. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are reapproved as amended. And members, we are done. Thank you very much to the testifiers.
Yeah.